Coming up on episode number 344, I get a chance to sit down and talk to Tim English, author of the book Sounds Like Teen Spirit, and we talk about songs that sound like other songs, whether it's intended plagiarism or unintended. It's all coming up right now on Coverville.
Just getting rougher, cover me. Come on, baby, cover me. Well, I'm looking for a lover who will come on in and cover me.
Greetings from Coverville for a Thursday night. It's July 19th, 2007. I'm Brian Ibbett, and welcome to another interview edition of Coverville. I usually try and space these out, but with the current stuff going on with Avril Lavigne and the Rubinews, I thought that it was poignant to get this show out as quickly as possible. So, without further ado, let's get right into the interview with Tim English. My guest tonight is the author of the book Sounds Like Teen Spirit, Stolen Melodies, Ripped Off Riffs, and the Secret History of Rock and Roll. The book examines some of the most famous and some lesser-known cases of sound-alike tunes. Welcome to the show, Tim English.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Thank you. So let's first kind of talk a little bit about what the book, what we mean by stolen melodies, ripped off riffs, and the secret history of rock and roll. You want to go into that, kind of what the subject of the book?
Examines songs, and most of them are songs that the pop music fan would know, songs that appear to have borrowed their melodies from earlier songs. Some of these cases have ended up in court. The one that people may be most familiar with is the George Harrison, My Sweet Lord, and the Chiffons, He's So Fine case. There was also the Ghostbusters, I Want a New Drug case back in the 80s, and that ended up in a lawsuit. But I didn't want to make it a book about plagiarism and legal issues, because the legal issues get boring in a hurry. I really designed the book kind of as an interactive experience, Brian, for where you have the song pairings, and then people can kind of hopefully check the songs out for themselves. And I provide the background information on the different composers and performers and who recorded what when, and whether the author of song A was aware of the first song, which usually they were.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope with the book that people will sort of be able to hear familiar music in a new way, and it's a kind of a unique prism to look at the whole history of rock and roll.
Oh, absolutely. And this because I actually had the book before you and I had even started talking. I picked it up a couple months ago, and I was just fascinated by some of these, and did exactly what you described. I went out and found some of these songs, and so it's kind of coincidental that you had emailed and we'd started talking about bringing you on the show. So I'm glad to have you on.
Well, I guess great minds think alike, Brian.
That's right, because it's kind of a similar path. It's not exactly cover songs. It's a similar path, though, because the melodies are the same, or in some cases the lyrics are the same. It's just kind of an unintentional cover, or an unplanned, or a subconscious cover, I guess.
Well, going back to the George Harrison one, the judge said it was subconscious plagiarism, that he hadn't planned on doing that, but it doesn't really matter in the legal sense. It doesn't matter if it was subconscious or conscious. You still can be liable for it. I think you're right, though. In most of these cases, it just was a subconscious thing. I've always been sort of fascinating with how, if you're a composer, how do you know that the melody you think is original really is, and not something that you heard, after a few beers the other night or something, or walking down a street somewhere. There's a famous case of Paul McCartney where he had the melody to Yesterday, and he really thought it was a good song, and he went around for a couple weeks asking people, what is this? You know, what is this melody? And people said, well, we don't know what it is. It's pretty good, I guess. And so that's an example of that, how can you be sure that it's original?
Well, let's get into some of the examples. You and I had kind of talked about some of the, maybe a couple lesser known examples of this,
Great.
A lot of these are a few of my favorite songs. And it's funny, this first one you bring up, Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin, and Taurus.
Oh, this song people may have heard a time or two.
Yeah, they may have heard that. And then the song Taurus by Spirit, which actually, because of this, way back when Apple announced iTunes and the iTunes Music Store, Taurus was the first song that I bought specifically because of hearing about this this connection.
Really? Good for you. Yeah, I was, Taurus is not a song that I think the general public is all that familiar with. I would not have checked it out either if I hadn't heard rumor of this connection. Mm-hmm. But Taurus is kind of, I think I describe it in the book, as you have visions of a Haight-Ashbury crash pad circa 67 or so. You can almost smell the incense in the air as you listen to the song, but sure enough, a little ways into the song is the opening kind of arpeggiated chords that we're also familiar with in the beginning of Stairway to Heaven.
Right. Well, let's listen to a little bit of that right now. Okay, so that was Spirit by Taurus. I'm sorry, Taurus by Spirit, and Stairway to Heaven by Led Zeppelin. Yeah, you can definitely hear a little bit of the influence in there. Holy cow! I'm amazed that that's not a more commonly known connection.
Well, people are familiar with Zeppelin has run afoul of copyright issues quite a few times. Oh, yeah. Outline in the book, but this particular case, there were some connections between Zeppelin and Spirit. They actually recorded, it's been reported that they recorded the Spirit song Fresh Garbage for their debut album, and that has never been released. They also apparently shared a bill or two on Zeppelin's first tour. So I think we could say that Jimmy Page and Zeppelin were familiar with their body of work.
Yeah, definitely. And that never ended up in any sort of legal...
No, it did not, but I've seen at least one article online where Randy California, who was the author of Taurus and the guitarist for Spirit, he passed away about 10 years ago, but I've seen that his mother had been speaking out about it and maybe... possibly seeking some sort of legal remedy. It's still a relatively small part of the overall song Stairway to Heaven, but you know, that's the latest I've seen about it. There's never been any legal action initiated yet, as far as I've heard.
Yeah, but when any budding, you know, rock guitar performer picks up a guitar, that's one of the first licks that they try and learn is that that opening to Stairway to Heaven. So it's It definitely gets a lot of...
it sure does, and yeah. That's something that, now you know where it originally apparently came from.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Now let's look at another one here. This one, actually, you had had brought up, and I was looking for it in the book here to just kind of have it in front of me, but I'm not sure it's in here. The Beautiful Day by U2 and The Sun Always Shines on TV by A-ha.
Yes.
And it's funny.
Now, I think most of your listeners will remember the A-ha of Take On Me fame back in around 1985 was actually a song that actually still sounds pretty good. I mean, so much of the 80s stuff, if you listen to a Saturday Night at the 80s show or something, most of it sounds very compressed and you hear a lot of drum machine, sounds pretty cheesy. I mean, Take On Me and this song, The Sun Always Shines on TV, still sound pretty good, in my opinion. I was not a huge fan of that type of music, but I think they still sound pretty good. They're both on the same album, which is called Hunting High and Low. And funny enough, the hit in the UK and a lot of Europe was the song The Sun Always Shines on TV, and Take On Me was not a hit. But The Sun Always Shines on TV, I believe, was maybe even the number one in the UK. So it was certainly a song that everybody in that part of the world was aware of, if not most of the people over here.
Right. Well, the video for Take On Me absolutely was, I think, what helped kind of propel it here in the U.S.
It was a very cool video, and I think it's been voted, as you know, various surveys over the years, as one of the top videos ever. Mm-hmm.
And The Sun Always Shines on TV actually continued. It was almost like a sequel to the Take On Me video, because he, Pal Wackatar, I think is, Morton Harkett, I think is the vocalist there, actually starts phasing into that drawn style that he had in Take On Me at the very beginning of The Sun Always Shines on TV.
Yeah, well, when this song, when U2's Beautiful Day came out in 2000, the similarities between these two songs were commented on, mostly in the British music press, and Bono kind of made a sly allusion to it in one of the award shows over there, where he sang Beautiful Day, and at the end he sort of said with a wink, "And the sun always shines on TV." So he was having fun with it, and I have a quote or two in the book from... I think it was Larry Mullen, the U2's drummer. He said, yes, it was definitely similar, but it was never meant as plagiarism or anything. In other words, it was sort of a subconscious thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's been acknowledged. The similarities have been acknowledged by both the people in A-ha and then the guys in U2.
Oh yeah, I think when I first heard "Beautiful Day," because I was a big A-ha fan when
Were
I first
you really?
Heard. Oh yeah, yeah, still am actually. They still come out with albums.
They're big in lots of other parts of the world.
They really are. Still putting out albums. But when I first heard "Beautiful Day," and that chorus came in, I actually started singing the lyrics to "Sun Always Shines on TV," just kind of out of hey, listen to this, and so it's I'm glad that it's one of the ones you included here, because sure, everybody has those little moments where you know, they're sitting there thinking, hey, you know, this Sheryl Crow song sounds a lot like "Stuck in the Middle with You" by Steeler's Wheel. That "All I Want to Do."
Right.
I'm sure that's one that people always, or you probably had that one in the book too. I didn't see it on first glance.
I don't know, but it certainly could have been. But yeah, it's nice to have your opinions affirmed, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's listen to a little bit of the U2 song "Beautiful Day," and then we'll phase into "The Sun Always Shines on TV" by A-ha. So we're back. Yeah, that the melody and even some of the lyrics are pretty similar.
Well, that's when you really can tell the similarity, I think, when you have both the lyrics and the melody are the same.
Right.
It's really that. I think it's very, very obvious. In fact, I quote The Edge, U2's guitarist, The Edge, in the book, who said it's positively creepy how alike the songs are. So yeah, it was just, I guess, one of those things that was rattling around and came out again when they were writing "Beautiful Day."
Right. Now, there have been some songs that have been very obvious in their borrowing of lyrics. I mean, the one that comes to mind is "Chinese Cafe," by Joni Mitchell, which borrows a little bit of the lyrics and melody from Unchained Melody by the Righteous Brothers. I guess that's not the perfect example that I was thinking of. I mean, Sting has done it a dozen times where he will bring in a police refrain into the end of one of his songs.
A little bit of an allusion. The Beatles sang a little bit of She Loves You at the end of All You Need Is Love. What
right.
was the song Hootie and the Blowfish did? They began singing the words to Bob Dylan's Idiot Wind. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
In Only Want to Be With You, I think it was, where she shot a man named Gray and took his wife to Italy.
Oh,
for no
really?
Apparent reason. They began reciting the words to that song in the middle of their song.
I think the song even mentions Bobby. I think he just used the name Bobby, in the song, in the Hootie and the Blowfish song, I think they even kind of allude to Bob Dylan in that.
Well, they recite a few of the lines, and maybe they do talk about him in there, too, a little bit. But,
yeah,
there are plenty of songs that make allusion to other songs. Even Mrs. Robinson makes an allusion to I Am the Walrus.
To the Cuckoo Cachoo, right.
To Mrs. Robinson. So, yeah, there are quite a few of those, too, little lyrical allusions.
Now, what is it when the... when the second performer actually credits the original performer in the publishing, that's kind of what makes it okay in some cases to do that. Or I guess in all cases, as long as they credit the original performer. And I guess there have been some cases where the original artist got added to the credits of the song later on.
A few of those have involved Led Zeppelin. On the Zeppelins, if anybody has the original copies of their first couple albums, the song Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You was credited, I think it says traditional, arrangement by Jimmy Page. The only problem was this traditional had been copyrighted around 1958-59. Its copyright was still in effect to a woman named Ann Breeden, who was a kind of obscure folk singer in San Francisco. But another example of this is Bob Dylan's Forever Young was pretty much copied by Rod Stewart for his song of the same title, which certainly borrows a lot from it lyrically and a little bit musically, not too much. But Bob Dylan is now on that copyright of the Rod Stewart song.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of these things get worked out, a couple of phone calls between the lawyers, and everybody's happy. I think it's in everybody's interest not to have a big public...
Right.
Bad about it.
And the Bittersweet Symphony, another one that was actually, I mean, that ended up losing the Verve a lot of money because here is this, you know, hugely popular song, and they borrow not even a Rolling Stone, not even actual Rolling Stones music, but borrow music from a cover of the Rolling Stones, which
and the cover doesn't even sound like. I mean, it is the last time was the song, but it doesn't. I mean, that music on the Verve and on I guess on this original by the Andrew Lou Goldham Orchestra doesn't really sound like the last time.
Right.
But there you go. They didn't clear the permission for the sampling, and they ended up paying for it big time.
Wow. And, of course, the big prominent case right now that's going on is Avril Lavigne and the Rubinews with Girlfriend by Avril and I Want to Be Your Boyfriend by the Rubinews. What's your take on this? After doing this book and kind of seeing where most of these end up, what do you think is going to be the outcome?
Well, I noticed in this one that there apparently looked like there were some discussions among the lawyers before this went public that they announced retroactively that the suit had been filed. I'm old enough to remember the Rubinews. I actually saw them open a show for Elvis Costello back, I think it was 1979.
Oh, wow.
And saw them perform this song. So I'm dating myself here, Brian, but at that time we all thought that this song sounded like Get Off My Cloud by the Stones.
Right.
So I think probably the issue that Avril Lavigne, the problem she has here is not so much the songs really sound all that alike, but you have the Hey You deal, and then you have the girlfriend-boyfriend thing, the same word. So you're getting quite a few similar elements in there, and you're probably headed for some sort of out-of-court deal here and a small settlement. I've noticed in a lot of these cases, though, that the more successful And the more money is at stake in the person being sued, the more you tend to attract these lawsuits. Avril Lavigne is one of the few people in 2007 that still sell a lot of albums. So if that were not the case, you probably wouldn't even be hearing about this.
But, yeah.
Girlfriend was a big hit, and the album has sold about a million, I think, so far.
And the Rubinews were certainly a lot less well-known than she is, so kind of...
Not a household word.
No.
maybe not even in their own household.
Right. Well, let's talk about another one here. And this one I had not heard until you and I started talking, which is the John Lennon version of Imagine. And then Freddie, is it Freddie Lennon? His
Alfred
father.
Freddie Lennon, yeah. John's dad. Yeah. Well, I was very surprised by this. I had seen this story in a book by a guy named Christopher Engelhofer, I believe it is. And this Engelhard, I think, he, for anybody who's a real Beatle fan, he has a book where he compiled all the Beatles guest sessions that they'd done over the years. And it's really, really comprehensive. For anybody who's into that stuff, I'd recommend his book. But he had the story in there that, and I'll just to go back into the story, John, as a lot of people know, was father left home when he was maybe 2 or 3 years old, never had much contact with him as he grew up, John being raised by his aunt for most of the time. Then John gets famous and rich and is a Beatle, and his father reappears on the scene, goes to the newspapers in London with a sob story that he's washing dishes for a little, you know, at some hotel in London, and why won't my son talk to me, and things of that sort. Eventually, they did have a rapprochement, but some producer, a pretty prominent guy, I think, got hooked up with Freddie, and they recorded this song called That's My Life, My Love, and My Home. And it was sort of a play on the Beatles song, In My Life, which was popular at that time. We're talking late 65 here. And it talks about his life as being a sailor. And I had never heard this song before, although it is on some compilations. It's probably on iTunes if people want to check it out. And the chords are very similar and sort of the stately tone of the songs. And in Engelhofer's book, he says that... John used to play his father's record for friends at his house. It's sort of a goof, you know, like, hey, what do you think of this? So
wow.
I think we can say he was aware of it. And it's just an intriguing thing. These songs are not really note for note similar. I'm not saying they are, but I just think that it's such a neat story and such a intriguing possibility that this sort of cash-in novelty record that Freddie recorded may have inspired what's considered one of the great humanist rock anthems, Imagine.
Absolutely. Well, let's listen to a little bit of each of them.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. Sky. I'll pick up my story where I once left off. I sailed with the tides and lived on dreams. I've watched the sunrise over every ocean.
That's my life, that's my love, and my home.
Okay, and we're back. Yeah, that's, you know, we talk about Oasis being, you know, fairly... prominently borrowing from the Beatles. That's certainly a case of, I think, personally, I think that that's definitely John Lennon borrowing some elements from his father.
Isn't that amazing?
That
and the voice of Freddie Lennon, to hear his voice is very eerie, too. That Liverpool voice that we all know so well. This guy who was kind of a ne'er-do-well, yet he at least was a biological father to a guy who is, you know, one of the real geniuses. So amazing how the world works.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go to another one here. This is a great one. Rod Stewart's Do You Think I'm Sexy and Jorge Ben's Taj Mahal. Let's listen to this one first. Yeah, there.
That's a little bit of similarity there.
Wow, you can just sing along. You can just sing the words right along with the Jorge Ben song.
And you know, I have to admit, I mean, a lot of people disliked that song, the Rod Stewart song at the time. All the rock critics and Rolling Stone were calling him a sellout, and maybe betrayed his rock and roll roots and gone Hollywood. But I always thought it was a pretty cool song, and I still do, and I think it holds up pretty well. That said, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious to anybody who hears the songs where that song had its origin, in the Jorge Ben song from 1972 that was a big hit in South America. It was played in a lot of the clubs in Europe. Expect that Rod Stewart might hang out, I think.
Sure.
And they did get into legal action over that as right around the time, or as it was being said, Rod Stewart decided to donate his royalties to the song for UNICEF in a big show that was taking place at the UN, I believe it was January of 79, and that was the end of it. I did find a quote from Jorge Ben, who's still around, and he said, "I'm glad people liked Rod Stewart's song, but I don't like when people just kind of take something without crediting it," although he does now have a credit on that song, if anybody's got a recent Rod Stewart best of.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He was added afterwards.
Yeah, retroactively. And he said, "I'm glad the song is being helping the kids in the world through UNICEF, but it would have been nice if somebody had asked me beforehand before they donated my money." But yeah, a pretty obvious lift on that one, I think, Brian.
Absolutely. Now, do you think Rod Stewart's move was more of a kind of a put on a show to say, you know what, I'll acknowledge that, and as a goodwill gesture, I'll give the money to UNICEF? Or do you think he was just trying to keep it away from Jorge Ben?
Well, isn't it kind of a thing like where two guys are walking down the street and the guy, stick-up man, approaches them and the guy says, "Give me your money," and you say to your friend, "Hey, Joe, here's the $20 I owe you," you know? And
right.
Then the robber takes it. So it's kind of the best of both. You get the lawsuit to go away, and you get the credit for being a good philanthropist.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So. All right, one more here. And actually, before we get to that one, let me ask you just kind of how, you know, how the book, what kind of reception you've gotten. I mean, obviously, you've had a few interviews. It sounds like it's doing really well.
It has been doing pretty well. It was published by iUniverse, and it's gotten attention in a lot of national media. Howard Stern had it on in March. Chicago Tribune, Harp Magazine reviewed it in their June issue and gave it a nice review. And there's going to be some more of the similar things coming up. One of the nice things about this topic is you can, at some point in the future, we're going to do a new edition and add some new things, because we always have these cases coming up. Even in the time since I finished the original book about 9 months ago, there have been at least three or four of these have cropped up again, and it's been doing pretty well. It's the reason I wrote it. It's a book that I've heard you describe yourself as a music geek, Brian, and I am too, and it's the type of book that when I go to the bookstore, I would buy myself. I'm always looking for, we've all heard a lot of the same stories, a lot of the stories get regurgitated. I was really looking for a new way to see, you know, the history of rock, of a sort of a prism in which to look through to see, you know, the history there. And I hope people will kind of have that aha moment, not the Norwegian band, but that aha moment where they compare the songs themselves and hear the similarities. And I hope they'll hear familiar music in a new way and also get into some artists that they hadn't before. I certainly have on this journey of writing the book. I've gotten exposed to a lot of great music and performers I was not aware of before.
That's great. And I'm sure in the process of people reading this book, they've come to you and said, oh, you know what song I've always thought sounded the same? And they come to you and make suggestions for ones for the next edition. Do you always do you find that some of them you just can't hear it?
There are a few I can't hear it. I mentioned that Paul McCartney yesterday. The guy he wrote a book a couple years ago. It got some media attention where he claimed that that song was that Yesterday was the same melody as Answer Me, My Love by a Nat King Cole song from the 50s. I would have included it in the book, but I just don't think they sounded at all alike. Uh-huh. I mentioned in the book that in one of his, I think it was in his Playboy interview, John Lennon said that the Rolling Stones had ripped off his song Bless You for their big hit Miss You. And, you know, it's there might be a little something there, but I really don't hear it. So unless I really heard it myself, and a lot of this is subjective, mm-hmm. And even I was on a program with a lawyer a few days ago, and really when you get into court on these things, a lot of it is subjective. It depends on the ears that the jury has. You
right.
have to prove that the person could have heard the song, but you also have to show that the songs are similar, and that's a very subjective judgment that you make. So some people may agree with these, and some people may not. But it's fun; it's certainly a fun subject to debate among music fans.
Absolutely, huh? All right. Well, let's get into the last one here that I wanted to bring out. This one, I actually don't remember the Bonnie Tyler song. Of course, everyone's heard the Bon Jovi song. I'm talking about Bon Jovi's "You Give Love a Bad Name" and Bonnie Tyler's "If You Were a Woman and I Was a Man." And I think I've heard all of Bonnie Tyler's, you know, big, big hits in multiple covered versions, but certainly hadn't heard "If You Were a Woman, I Was a Man," and was just blown away by how close those two are.
I have a section of the book called "Songs They Ripped Off for Themselves," and that could be in this. This pairing could be in that section, because the fellow who worked on both songs is a songwriter named Desmond Child, and this guy's resume of songs. You can check it out on his website. I was just amazed at all the hit records this guy's been involved with. Anybody mm-hmm. who says that all the songs on the radio sound the same would have some ammunition to prove that if you look at his website, because he's written co-written all of Bon Jovi's hits with Sambora and Bon Jovi, but I would say almost all their early famous ones. Mm-hmm. He's also written The Thong Song by Sisqo. He's written Livin' La Vida Loca by Ricky Martin. He's written Dude Looks Like a Lady by Aerosmith. I mean, it's and on, many more. So he had been working with Bonnie Tyler on her album that came out in early 1986, and I guess his next project was Bon Jovi's breakthrough album, Slippery When Wet, a huge album that sold over 10 million copies in the U.S., and they obviously retrofitted this song with a decent lyric. I think most people would agree. I've heard the song a number of times, the Bonnie Tyler song. I'm still trying to figure out just what it's about. But Bon Jovi and Sambora working with them really came up with a classic with You Give Love a Bad Name. So for people who don't think the lyrics are important, I would beg to differ, at least right. In this case.
Do you think they just they kind of wrote off the Bonnie Tyler song and said, well, that's never going to be a hit. Let's just repurpose the melodies and everything for the Bon Jovi song?
I'd be speculating on that, but that's certainly possible. I don't know. The Bonnie Tyler song was not a hit here, but it was a hit in Europe. It was a number one hit in some of those European countries, I believe, some of the Scandinavian countries. So go figure. You know, there's no accounting for taste, but I guess they figured that they could do a very good job with it, and so they went ahead and did it.
Mm-hmm.
And very successfully, too.
Right. Right. Wow. Yes, there was a case, you know, I was just thinking of another case here that was just recent, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, Danny California, and Tom Petty's.
Mary Jane's Last Dance.
Exactly, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did that
one? I hear that, and it's kind of more the riff and the rhythm in that, I think. There are some similarities there.
Mm-hmm.
More so, I think, rhythmically and the chords in there, yeah.
Right, but I think it was the first one. It's certainly the first song that I remember people actually putting together in this day and age of technology and the underground kind of mashup movement. It's the first example of one of these plagiarism or suggested plagiarism cases where I've heard somebody actually do mashups of the two songs. And now, you know, with the Ruben Ouse and the Avril Lavigne song, it's becoming, you know, it's something that's going to be more prevalent. So I think if you're going to get caught doing something like this, because of the viral nature of the internet, it's going to be a lot more, it's going to be a lot easier for people to kind of point that out and kind of bring it to the forefront with a mashup or some sort of viral comparison of the two songs.
There's sort of a gotcha factor at work, I think, with some of that going on. When I had started this book, it was really just as the internet was coming into play. And I was, you know, the internet has made it possible for everybody out there to be able to hear these songs and compare them for themselves, and that's one of the great things. I mean, the book, it adds so much to your enjoyment of the book if you can do that, and that's easy to do it now. 10 years ago, it would have been more of an issue, but now it's easy to do, and I think it enhances the book quite a lot when people can do that.
Oh, absolutely. Terrific. Well, this has been a lot of fun. I mean, listening to these and kind of coming up with other ones. I'm sure after we're done talking, I'm going to come up with a couple more that I probably wanted to ask you about. But Timothy, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me here.
Well, you have a great show, and it's really been my pleasure to be on and be a part of it. And I'm glad to just want to thank you for helping to spread the word about Sounds Like Teen Spirit. If anybody out there who's into music, if you're music geeks like Brian and I, you'll certainly enjoy the book, I can guarantee you.
Absolutely, and I'll put a link in the show notes to where you can pick it up at Amazon. And I hope you'll let me know when the second volume or the second edition comes out. Is it going to be it's going to be an expanded edition of it's not going to be a sequel, it's going to be just kind of an expanded edition of this one, right?
That's right, and we're probably looking possibly late in the year on that, but I'll certainly let you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there any legal way to include a CD? There probably isn't, to include a CD with the book with snippets of the songs, I think.
Well, people have asked about that, but you know they can't even put out WKRP in Cincinnati with that with the original music in it now because the licensing is so prohibitive.
Right.
And I think if you're someone who's going to be interested in this book, I mean, songs like More Than a Feeling, Smells Like Teen Spirit, The Beatles, The Stones, I mean, people are going to have those in their collection, and it's a few of the more obscure ones that you're going to have to seek out, but. Yeah, I guess if we we put a big price tag on before we could license some of these, but I shudder to think of what the licensing bill would look like.
Oh, yeah,
to do.
The next edition of the book would be $300 or something like that.
Maybe just to break
even. All right. Yeah. Well, Tim, thank you so much for your time. And definitely let me know when the next edition comes out. And I really appreciate, again, you taking the time to talk with me here.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much, Brian.
Thanks, Tim. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
And with that, we'll bring this cover-to-cover interview with Tim English to a close. Thank you very much to Tim for joining me for the program. Thank you for listening. And if you have some comments or other songs that you think are borrowed or borrow elements from other songs, leave a message on the weblog or in the forums. Just click right on this show's comments and add your 2 cents. Or you can send me an email at coverville@gmail.com. You can call the request line at 206-222-COVER, or of course post a message in the forums as well. We'll be back on Sunday night with another all-request edition of Coverville. Until then, this is Brian Ibbett saying that just about covers it for tonight. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time. Bye-bye. Coverville is a proud member of the Backbeat Media Podcast Network, and bandwidth for Coverville was provided by CacheFly, CacheFly.com.